4, 3, 2, 1, and liftoff of Space Shuttle Atlantis to assemble the framework for the science laboratories of tomorrow.
Houston now controlling.
Houston Atlantis, roll program.
This is the Cosmosphere Podcast, episode 31, and our first for 2024. In today's episode, we've got a look at what's going on at the Cosmosphere, an update on construction, and the audio from a talk given by astronaut Steve Swanson at the Cosmosphere this past March. The little intro audio from today was the launch of STS-117, which was Steve Swanson's first mission to space. Stay tuned for Steve's talk and some bonus questions we asked him after his presentation. Before we head to the Hall of Space to hear how updates are coming along, I've got a programming note. In the nearly 7 years of podcasting that I've been doing, I've never lost an episode or audio files until now. The files that I had been editing for the long-awaited JWST have disappeared. I don't know how. I feel like they've slipped beyond the event horizon of a black hole because for the life of me, I cannot figure out what happened to them. I'm not sure if it was an Adobe thing, a Mac OS problem. I'm sure we'll have more opportunities, though, to cover the incredible science being done with JWST in a future episode, just because that mission continues to show us absolutely just incredible views of the universe and our place in it. While we're on the topic of space science, 2024 is NASA's heliophysics big year, and there are a ton of opportunities to learn about our sun, and events are running now through Christmas Eve 2024, when NASA's Parker Solar Probe makes its closest approach to our sun. There's a ton of different monthly themes for the heliophysics big year, art, a back-to-school month, Earth's environment, and more. Check out NASA's website for more details. The link will be in the show notes. April's theme was obviously the total solar eclipse, which was visible for what seems like just about everyone but me this year. I was part of an event in Texas on Eclipse Day, and the clouds just didn't cooperate. It was a great time, though. The Ty Preston Memorial Library was great, as was the people from the New Braunfels Astronomy Club. I just want to thank everyone for making us feel welcome and hanging out that day. Now, let's check in with Chuck McClary and my daughter Astrid, who was along for the ride that day, for an update on what's going on at the Cosmosphere. I'm sure this won't be the only time we hear from Astrid in this podcast. She's 7 months old now and getting more and more vocal every day. You may hear some squawks or some laughs at various points of this episode, so bear with us on that. I'm here with Chuck McClary. We're actually down in the Hall of Space. There's some construction going on. Chuck is going to tell us a little bit about what's going on right now. And if you've ever been, Astrid agrees. There's lots of stuff going on here. If you've ever been to the Hall of Space, there's going to be a lot of really cool changes coming up. And it's starting with what's now going to be a classroom.
Yeah, so the area that was once our kind of our blockhouse area, we had Enos's couch right where you see this square on the ground.
Yes. For those of you in radio land, it's a dark gray concrete.
Yeah, but grayer than the rest of the gray.
Yes, exactly.
So Enos's couch used to be in here. We also had an Atlas engine and a Redstone engine. The Atlas and Redstone engines are both going to be put back in this area, and the I believe is going to go in this area as well.
Very cool news.
Yeah, and along with that, there are going to be a lot of interactives that teach kids and adults how rockets actually function. So kind of like Dr. Goddard's lab, but instead of watching a whole presentation, you get to use interactives that you actually engage with, and it teaches you how they work. And then we're still able to get through this area to go to the Titan II pit. That, I believe, will be unchanged. Okay. And then our shuttle gallery, what used to be our shuttle gallery, is going to be a new classroom area for our education department.
Awesome.
And actually, I'll pull the plastic back and you can see.
Walk over here a little bit. So it's
So that's where our shuttle gallery used to be.
Yeah.
Let's get away from that guy. That's where our shuttle gallery used to be, and it is now going to be a classroom.
Okay.
Which, having worked in the education department, I can tell you will be very helpful.
Yeah.
We used to have two classrooms down in the museum area, and they were pretty sizable, and that got turned into Cosmo Kids.
Perfect for you here in just about a year. Yeah, you got things to say about Cosmo Kids there, little miss. So lots of good things happening, and like just as we're walking around here too, we're over by the German wall. All of the old backlit panels are starting to come down too. So
And honestly, I'm pretty happy about that because the backlit panels, they started to fade after several years here.
Yeah,
but. The new panels are going to be like the ones in the previously remodeled sections of the museum, where, you know, they can be taken down if they need to and replaced, or they can be cleaned by just wiping them off and they won't wear out like these.
Big improvement.
So the way you see this now, how there's, you know, no real displays or anything like that. It's ripped apart, but you can still walk through it.
Yep.
This is how we hope the museum will be towards the middle of the summer.
Okay.
The entire museum will be walkable by about the summer, but there won't be displays ready yet.
Okay.
All of the construction will be done by, we're hoping, Christmas.
Okay.
We'll
do updates throughout the summer.
Yeah, and we're saying end of 2024 is when it'll all be done.
Which is going to be here before we know it.
All right, we're going to move on to another part of the museum here now.
All right, so we are just now in the space photography exhibit. We're working our way over towards Odyssey. And Chuck has a little detour here for us.
Of course I do. I love all this stuff. But so a couple months back on our YouTube feed, there's a video about the Nikon F that was used on Apollo 17. This one right here.
Okay.
Or maybe it's that one. Doesn't matter. I got to handle it. It was really cool.
Okay, sweet.
It was a lot of fun.
We'll link to that in the show notes.
But the Nikon F is a tank, and you pick that thing up and you can feel that it's built like a tank. And
it looks solid.
Yeah. But it's painted the ones that were used by NASA were painted entirely black so that they wouldn't get the reflection of like a silver camera or white writing on the glass as they were taking photos out the windows.
Okay.
But you can see that back when they were using this Zeiss, they hadn't quite done that yet. But that one always reminds me of the rear window camera. But I'm getting a little distracted. You know, the rear window, the Hitchcock film.
I have actually never seen it. All right. I know of Hitchcock, just never seen that one.
It's Jimmy Stewart. Look out behind you, kid.
Oh, God. Okay, now I feel silly. Wait, is that the one where he's like broken leg or whatever?
Uh huh.
Okay, yeah.
And he's with Grace Kelly, who's like way too young for him in that movie.
It was a different time.
Anyway.
Oh, man.
All right, so we're going to meander over here before Astrid gets too mad, and then rest of the plastic tarps are up. Everybody can still see Odyssey. Tell us a little bit about the shorts that you're doing on social. Those are great, and they'll be in the show notes as well.
Awesome. So we're doing a series on YouTube and Instagram called our Hard Hat Series, where we just do either talk about the construction itself, or we feature an artifact that's off display during construction and show it to you so you can see it even though it's not on display currently. Or we might talk about some of the artifacts that have not been on display for the last, you know, 20 or something years that will be on display now.
Which there's a lot of.
Yeah, so we've got a lot of great content that we're going to be doing once or twice a week, depending on how much I have on my calendar and how much I can edit at a time.
Another feeling.
Yeah.
Another feeling.
But
Astrid agrees.
Yeah, Astrid agrees. But they're really fun videos. Most of them so far have been myself and Shannon, our curator. And
do you like purposefully jump scare her sometimes? I feel like she's really easy to scare, maybe.
No, those were actually all planned, the intros. But in that first one, when she kind of like backs away from me, it's because I accidentally went too fast and like hit her in the shoulder with my phone. Oh, my God. She. But anyway. Apollo 13, as you can see, is still on display.
Yes.
Which we're going to leave that on display as long as possible.
Okay.
And then I'll let you get some nice,
what do they call that, Foley?
Yeah, some Foley. So the lem no longer has the kitty litter down below it.
It was literally kitty litter?
No.
Okay.
It was just a different type of gravel, but we called it kitty litter.
Okay, that's funny.
The rover... is going to be back on display once the construction's done and everything. You can see the white room over here
has moved. Or
I've heard implications that they have special plans for the white room, but I don't know what those are.
Okay.
And then we have our LEM trainer over here as well.
Awesome.
I can't quite tell what's under the tarp where those guys are, but
there's lots of good stuff happening down here.
Well, we're going to get back upstairs because there's lots of construction going on here. But Chuck, thank you for taking a few minutes to show us what's going on. Oh, yeah. Astrid's got things to say, too.
Yes,
do you want to be included here, too? All right. I get it. Well, we better get rolling before she gets too spicy. So we'll talk to you again soon, Chuck.
Wait, she might be doing the outro right now.
we'll leave it in there.
A big thank you to Chuck for showing us around yesterday. I did have to use the beep button. It wasn't due to language or anything like that, but there's a little surprise that we're just not ready to share publicly just yet. So stay tuned for more details. And now let's get to the talk that astronaut Steve Swanson gave this past March. Also, be sure to stick around at the end. We've got some questions that we asked Steve after his presentation. Enjoy.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you very much. You heard my name already, former NASA astronaut, right? Good, very much. I also worked at NASA for 28 years, 11 as an engineer, and actually that was really fun for me too. I think one of the benefits of working at NASA is being with a whole team of people who are really passionate about what they do. And I didn't realize that was really rare in life, because I was there for 28 years, and then I moved someplace else, and then not everybody liked that, but it was a benefit for me to have that group of people and be part of this mission that actually built the space station. So just as a shout out to NASA a little bit for me, that was a really positive place to work for me. So if any of you young kids want to have a very great job, go to NASA, okay? So I get the question a lot, and I'm sure you guys have it here, what's space like, right? Is it fun? What do you think? You know, could be, right? So I'm gonna show a little video to start off with to hopefully answer that question for you. When we were on the space station for 6 months, we got our Sundays off, and we would play on Sunday and videotape it and record it. And then this is some of that video we got to do on the board. Space?
Yeah.
I'll go back again. Yeah. It was a good time. My first mission was in 2007 on Space Shuttle Atlantis to the National Space Station. And we were bringing up a piece of the space station, a solar array, in the cargo bay. And our job was to attach it to the space station. And after I lucked out on this mission as being a rookie, I got to be the flight engineer who sits between its commander and pilot, runs the checklist, runs the operations on board the spaceship. And then I got to do two spacewalks and fly both a robotic arm on the space shuttle and on the space station. So that was a great mission. It lasted about 2 weeks. And we accomplished our mission of getting the solar array on. The next one was very similar. It was another shuttle flight to the National Space Station to put another solar array on. And since I had done the first one, and the person who was a pilot actually on that one was a classmate of mine, and we were both rookies on that one. And now he's the commander, and I'm now the lead spacewalker on this. So it was like you do it once, and now you're the expert, supposedly. And we were surprised that NASA thought that was a true statement, too. And we got that assignment, but we didn't screw it up, so I guess it was okay. So this one launched again, and this lasted about 2 weeks also to the International Space Station. And the launch is an amazing thing on the space shuttle. It is just a quite exciting ride, I'll put it that way. And, you know, to get to space only takes 8 minutes and 32 seconds. And we go from 0 miles an hour to 17,500 miles an hour. And that's a lot of speed, and that's a lot of change in velocity over 8 minutes and 32 seconds. And the solid rocket boosters on the vehicle are very, very powerful. They're the white things on the side. You'll see that in a minute here. But they are 3 million pounds of thrust each. Plus, when you put in the main engines of the shuttle, you get 7 million pounds of thrust. And the vehicle weighs about 4.5 million pounds. And so you are jumping off that launch pad. And by the time you reach the top of the part of the launch pad, we're already going 100 miles an hour. It's just an amazing vehicle. Let me show you a little bit more about the launch, though. About 2.5 hours prior to launch, we get in our suited up in these pressure suits, pumpkin suits we call them. We head out to the Astrovan. Actually, what's the technical name of it? The Astrovan. It goes out to the launch pad. We have a team there that helps us get into the vehicle, make sure we're all suited up correctly and strapped in well. And when we're done with that, they're going to close the hatch and seal it, and then let us be by ourselves while we do go through the countdown, et cetera, to get there. If within 6 seconds to go, we're going to light the main engines. And if they all work fine, then at T-minus zero, the solid rocket boosters are going to go, and they're going to light. And once they light, they cannot be turned off. So you're going somewhere at that moment.
4, 3, 2, 1. And booster ignition, lift off, space shuttle Discovery. Taking the space station.
So right there, we're already going 100 miles an hour. And it's part of the flight, you are back in your seat, you're on your back at this point, and you just got so much G's on your force, on your body, it is like somebody huge is sitting on your chest, making it a little difficult to breathe, and the vehicle is shaking quite a bit. Even so much, it's even hard to read our dials and gauges at this point, because the vehicle is shaking so much at this time. But we are going, say, quite fast. These solid rocket boosters last 2 minutes and 10 seconds. And then they run out of fuel, and they actually blow off of the vehicle and float back down under parachutes, land in the Atlantic Ocean, and get picked up and reused again. So there they go. Now, once that happens, though, it becomes a very quiet ride. Now it's very smooth. We're on the three main engines of the shuttle. It's a smooth flight for another 6 minutes, and we're just on our way. And really what we do, we go to orbit, we get up out of the atmosphere, and then we turn ourselves over so we can get the speed to go around the Earth. But we gotta go around fast so that we are in orbit around the Earth. And after 8 minutes and 32 seconds, we get main engine cutoff, which we call MECO. And this lady on the left is, we're her ride home. She's been on the station for 4 months. So she's pretty happy that we're coming to pick her up.
Discovery. Nominal MECO,
ohms 1
not required.
We get rid of the fuel tank. That's the orange tank. That was the fuel for the main engines of the shuttle. We're not going to use those again. So that drops off and actually burns up over the Indian Ocean. And then we're on our way to the International Space Station. So that is a shuttle launch. I also got the opportunity to do a Soyuz launch. That's definitely a very different vehicle. It is a capsule. It launches from Kazakhstan. And of course, made by the Russians. And the really interesting thing about launching it from this place, it was the same launch pad that Yuri Gagarin launched from, the first man in space. And it was I think one of the best benefits for me personally was we got to be part of this tradition that he set as the first man in space about all the things you do up here at the same launch pad before you go to space. And there's many different things from watching a movie the night before called The White Son of the Desert. It's in Russian, of course. And it is a terrible movie. But you have no choice. You have to watch it because sometime back in the 70s, one crew decided it was so bad they weren't going to watch it. and they didn't make it. So that means everybody now has to watch this movie. I mean, you have no choice. And then he did other things, like he signed the door of the room he slept in the night before. And one of the more interesting things he did was just before he got to the launch pad. It's like a 25-mile ride out to the launch pad from where you are and getting ready in Russia, or in Kazakhstan, excuse me. But he got out. He said, can you hold on the van here a second? I need to get out and relieve myself. And he did it on the tire of this vehicle that he was going out on. So we all have to stop before the launch pad and do that same thing just before you go to space. I thought that was really an interesting aspect to it, but it's Russian tradition and you gotta do it. Yeah. So this is the International Space Station. I don't know if you guys have seen pictures of it or not. And I think it's an amazing piece of equipment. It's about 360 feet across. You can see it has four solar panels on it. The middle section, and you can see the round stuff is where we live in. And it has the volume like of a large jumbo jet, like a 747, which is just amazing to me. It has a huge amount of volume on there. We have 6 or 7 people living on board at one time. And even though there's a large volume like that, though, it is not, as you probably saw in the earlier pictures, it's crowded with a lot of stuff. There's tons of science experiments. It's in the storage. We have to have supplies for anywhere between 6 months and a year on board at all time. So it's busy. And one of the hardest things, of course, to imagine with all that supply is where everything is on board, as people will come and leave and go. And so we have a whole team that tries to keep track of all that. And to me, one of the other interesting facts is these are all the different pieces to build that space station. And it took 35 shuttle flights and 4 Russian launches to bring all that stuff up. And it was all put together in space for the first time. So it was never tested on the ground at all together, because it was built by different countries and by different companies all around the world, and then put together in space, and it worked. That was, to me, one of the most amazing things of the whole thing. And the purpose of the space station, though, is science. That's what we were there for. While we were up there, we probably had 300 experiments going on. We worked on maybe 100, 150 of them ourselves. This one is called Spheres, which we can load different programs into these spheres, and they will do different things. We can test out different equations and ideas. Now, I am not a principal investigator or the scientist on any of these ones. None of us are. We are a glorified lab tech, right? We go in, we set them up, we work with the people who come up with the experiment, and we make sure they get good data, and that's our job. It's kind of fun, though, because you get to be part of tons of different experiments. This is fluid dynamics we did tests on. That behaves much differently in space. I'm going to show you more of that later. It's fun. But one of the other fun ones was fire. I mean, everybody likes to play with fire, right? So we got to do that in space. And it behaves much differently than it would here on Earth. We also had to do many on the human body to see what changes are happening to our body. That's when I'm just measuring the muscles in my leg to see how much I've lost over time. We are gonna lose some. We're also gonna lose some bone while we're up there. Even though we work out 2 hours every day, we're still gonna lose some. I got to grow the first edible food, romaine lettuce, on board. Yeah. They said we shouldn't eat it because they had to test it beforehand, being the first. However, some of it accidentally floated into my mouth. I don't know how. It was actually pretty good, considering, you know when plain romaine lettuce tastes really good, that's how you know about how bad the food on space station is. But we found out that being in space really is like growing old quickly. We have, I say, bone loss, muscle loss, vision problems, cardiovascular problems, immune system problems. It just goes on and on. And so we're trying to mitigate all these things. And hopefully if we can mitigate it for space, we can also do that for everybody here on Earth. And we came up with our own science. I'm going to call this science. Experiments ourselves. Yeah, this one was just creating a large, if you call it sphere, not a ball of water, because now it's science. We're calling it a sphere of water. And the idea was to go ahead and put a GoPro camera inside the water to see what that would look like. Because that's something you just can't do here on Earth. And I like to also think this is a really good example of just something you would think is as simple as water, how different it can be in space. So here's the GoPro camera coming in. Definitely gives you a shagadelic look of life. And so then to, you know, continue the experiment that we're working on, we decided to take an Alka-Seltzer tablet and toss it into the water to watch it go. And now, just to make it an experiment, I've explained a little science that I find very interesting, because I am a sort of a geek. As you see now, all the different little bubbles that it has now, over time, it becomes one big bubble inside, you know, the air bubble inside. And that's the, in physics, we call that trying to find the lowest energy state of the system. And that's what that's doing. So now we can call it real science. But it was really cool to it. And you'll see here in a second, my crewmate Reed, who happens to actually be now the commander of Artemis II, is going to grab the camera and try to get it more in the middle of it. And so it's going to give it a little bit of a push, but we've never played with this before, so we don't really know exactly what that's going to take. And he gives a little, probably too much. And then I'm going to try to grab the camera so I can point it at some of my crewmates and other things to take pictures through the water. But I realize as I go to grab it, that water is so sticky, that adhesion, cohesion of the water molecules is so strong that I gotta be really gentle with it. I can't really just shove my hand in there. So I gotta let it come up my hand. It's kind of like the blob in the old movie, right? And I'm kind of trying to devour my hand. And so I'm just letting it kind of work my way up so I can get in closer. Then I realize that if I just take my other hand, I can actually control the camera without even touching it by using the water. I mean, that's why it is so interesting to see how things behave without gravity. We can just play with water, something as simple as that, and just make an experiment out of that. Now, we did have a lot of fun with this, so we decided to try another one very similar to this experiment, or going down that path. So we made another big ball. And actually, that was actually pretty hard just to make the ball of water, not have it go off in any direction. We had to put the water into it from different angles to make sure it was still staying in one spot. We volunteered our roommate Alex here to go ahead and dive into it. If you look closely now, he's got water over his mouth, his nose, his eyes, everything. So he's underwater, right? And he can't breathe. And we didn't realize that until he started choking, but that was another minor detail. We never put this video down to ground until we got home because there's water floating around the station, which is probably not really allowed. Don't tell anyone about that. One of the things we have to do on a regular basis, of course, is the normal life kind of stuff. You know, you get up in the morning, you go to the bathroom, you brush your teeth, all that kind of stuff, but you also have to eat. So eating on board was a little different than here on Earth. We have two main types of food. This is dehydrated food, and we have packaged food. If we're lucky, you get something that's actually off-the-shelf packaged food, not NASA food. That stuff's better. So this is Reed. He's trying to find his favorite bar and have a little difficulty. That's our table with Sriracha, the most important thing on the space station. And now we're going to rehydrate some of the food here. And it's a pretty simple machine that you can actually just stick your packet of food in it. You can tell it, say, how much water, if you want hot or if you want room temperature. You push the button, it fills it up. You wait about 15 minutes. You have a pair of scissors you use to open up the package. And then you take your spoon, the one spoon you get for 6 months on board, and you use that, and you eat. And if you're lucky, you have something better. But this is eating. Just kind of shows you that we don't sit down, we float. We use our feet, though, to hold us in place. And you just let things float. You get so used to this environment, it becomes second nature. So you use the floating as an advantage. You know, you don't ever put really things down as much as you normally would here. And if you also notice, when you eat food, you got to think about using a spoon, and there's no gravity in the sense of free fall. So the food's not just going to stick to the spoon or stay on the spoon unless there's water or moisture on it. It gets sticky. So Alex over there is eating some rice, and you're only going to see in a second that some of that food comes off a spoon, which happens all the time in space. So then you have to chase your food a little bit and bring it back to your mouth and go get it. So just the way eating in space is always like playing with your food. It's just the way the system works up there. You can't really do much about it. And you notice I'm actually cleaning off the scissors also with a wet wipe. because that's all we have. We don't have running water on the space station. Here, Alex has got some food going off. So, yeah. Eating was just an adventure every day. Yeah. And it was also fun. One of the other things we get to do is look out the window towards Earth, which is just a fantastic thing. So this is the window. And this picture happens to be, though, the first Instagram from space. I got that opportunity to do that. I created an Instagram account called the ISS and took this picture and then sent it on down. And it is in the area we call the cupola. It has seven windows. There's one in the center and six around the sides. And this, to me, it was a great place to come down and look at our planet. So here's some video of that. But one thing I'd like you to know is that you can really see the planet in a different way up here. It's not like you're learning countries and the cities. You're really trying to do is you're learning, you really see the ecosystems of one big planet. And that's what you're really looking at way up here. And nighttime happened to be a really interesting thing for me. I loved it at nighttime because there was lightning always someplace on this planet. So you can see that those flashes. And you can see the whole lightning storm. You can see over 1,000 miles. And you watch the whole line of lightning in the thunderstorms as they go by. And it was really, really cool to watch that all the time. We get 16 sunrises and sunsets a day if we go around the Earth every 90 minutes. So they happen very quickly. And it's really bright when the sun comes up. So it goes from, you know, really pitch black to really bright. And this is sped up, but it lets you know, this is our view from the cupola. So this is what we saw every day as we went across the Earth. It was just amazing to be able to get these views and to be able to know our planet in this way. I wish everybody had the opportunity to do this. I think we'd have changes in the way we feel about our planet and other countries, because really there is no real borders if you look at it from this view up here. It was just an amazing sight. And you can really see at nighttime too, the differences between, you know, prosperous areas or very rural areas, stuff like that. It was amazing to see the differences across our planet. I just like this picture a little bit. This is one of the southern auroras. I got to take this picture. We actually got to have really good five auroras when I was up there. We just got to like fly through the auroras. So that was just a really unique thing also. You know, and also you can imagine living with the same people for 6 months, right? Even though you're good friends, some conflicts can arise, right? And so I'm gonna show you a little video about how to handle conflict resolution on the space station.
Up current ISS, we have arguments or disputes just like any other group of people would. And we like to handle them just like any civilized culture would handle.
Of course, we talk about like grown adults.
No, we duel! Duel! Let me give you your weapon.
Woohoo! I brought those up here.
We both get one bullet. And we started at other ends of the module. We float to each other. You get one shot, of course. First shot wins. However, if your shot misses, the other guy gets a point blank point because he flies closer to you. So, we're going to give it a try. He's been taking me off a little bit, so we have to do a duel.
Excellent.
You wrote my family name again.
I missed. So we maybe had some fun on the space station. This is spacewalking. Spacewalking is a really fun thing to do. You're going outside the ship in your own little ship, right? It's your own self-contained little ship, but you move around the whole space station with your arm. So the term spacewalking is not a really good term, right? It's a misnomer. It should be space or hand walking or something like that, because your feet don't do anything while you're out there. You're on for a ride. You can tell here we're moving around. And nothing happens quickly, though, in a spacewalk, because those suits are, even though we are floating, they are still have a lot of mass to them. And so they're not easy to move in. They're actually difficult to actually move your arms around a lot, because think about it. Since we're pressurized in a suit, we are inside a bubble, like a balloon, and you have to press against that force that would be in a balloon every time you move everything, your hands, your arms, your legs, anything like that. So it's a very much of a workout when you're out there. We're out there for 6 to 7 hours at a time. But it's also quite amazing. If you look at it, this kind of gives you a view of us on the space station when you're out there working away. It is an amazing little thing. And to me, the emotions too is kind of a wide range of emotions while you're out there on a spacewalk, because it's fun. At the same time, it's stressful because you're in a very hazardous environment with this difficult suit on, and you have everybody watching, make sure you do everything correctly. But they're still a great thing to be able to do. This is coming back in the Soyuz, so it's a little different, of course, than the shuttle. So coming back in the shuttle was like flying an airplane. This one's much different because it's just a capsule. And so when you come back in a capsule, you're going to come back much deeper into the atmosphere, which means the vehicle is going to get hotter. The shuttle is around 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. This is about 4,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And it creates this really interesting plasma around the vehicle. So you'll see this in a second at the window, this orange plasma. That's just what's around the vehicle. You're coming around. It's a very, very hot gas. And then it actually, the way it got dark there is because the heat shield is melting on the front and it's sloughing off and giving metal particles coming on over the rest of the vehicle as it goes by. And that's what it's supposed to do, because it goes through different layers. And then once that phase is over, and that's, we're at 4.5 Gs during this phase right now, going to the atmosphere at the beginning of it. We go on parachutes, and that's the parachutes, once you're on, those are fine. And then we're about 15 minutes on a parachute ride down, and then we hit the ground in the middle of Kazakhstan, and we're back on Earth. And about 55 minutes later, we have search and rescue crews will come and get us. And this is Kazakhstan, in case you've never seen it before. And this is the middle of nowhere. And this is definitely a definition of the middle of nowhere. There is not like a building or a tree within 100 miles of the place we land. That way, it could burn a parachute. They're not sure where we're going to land. So that way, we're not going to hit anything on that. But now, I will take questions if you have any questions. There's one, yes. What does it feel like to be weightless? Well, one, it feels fun to be able to do all those tricks, right? But the hard part is that when you first get to space, being weightless kind of upsets your stomach. You ever been on a roller coaster?
Yeah.
You know that first deep part when you go on a roller coaster, your stomach kind of goes up like because you're in free fall, right? We get that all the time. That's what happens when you go to space. So your stomach's not really happy with you right away, right? Salt mines all over again. You work in the salt mines? Okay, good. but once your body gets used to it, then it's really fun to be in a microgravity environment, a floating environment. It is great. It is wonderful. We're going back right here first. Yes. How far was it? What, sir? Oh, how hard was it to go back to living on Earth when you get back? Good question. There's a couple sides to that. So first, when I talked about that floating thing and why, you know, how your stomach gets upset, the reason your stomach gets upset is you have a part of your ear is called the inner ear, and that helps tell you, that helps with your balance. And what it does, it finds where gravity is and it lets you know which way gravity is so you can balance better. But when you're in space, that's all confused. And so to get to your stomach to feel better, your brain turns that off. It doesn't use it anymore, which is fine until you want to come back, because you need your balance to come back, right? And so when you first land, you are a little wobbly, right? I could walk when I landed after 6 months, but I was definitely on the wobbly side. I was walking kind of weird, and if I turned corners very quickly and like that, I would kind of sway a little bit more. And they make you do tests right when you land too, to see, say if you landed on Mars after 6 months, what could you be able to do? And so they did this test where, can you sit down, stand up? Can you lay down? Can you stand up? Can you walk? Can you climb over something? Can you do all these little tests to see? And I did everything fine until I got to the point where it said, close your eyes and try to walk. No, it didn't work out because I didn't have my inner ear working, right? It was just my eyes keeping my balance. As soon as I closed my eyes, I was over. So that took about 10 days to solve that problem, my body hit that back. And the other part was I just wasn't as strong and as I should be after being up there for that long. And so it took me about, I had 6 months of rehab to get back strong again. Yeah, even though we work out 2 hours a day up there, I still needed a bunch of rehab to get everything back. Yes. Yes. Oh, do things taste different when you're up there? Is that what you're asking? Yeah, so there is something to do that, and especially when you first get to space, we get a thing called fluid shift. And what it is, you know, your body has a lot of water in it, right? And so when you get to space, that water is actually normally held down by gravity, and your body is just not used to this kind of gravity thing, and the water's there. But without gravity, this water shifts up to your head, up this way, and your head actually swells, and it gets bigger. And it gets really, you get really stuffy in the tube, and you can't breathe well or through your nose, right? So your nose doesn't work as well. And a lot of taste comes from what your nose does, right? And so if people realize when they first get to space, they cannot taste things near as well as they could back on Earth. But over time, like a week or two, this your body adapts to that, and that goes away, and then you're kind of back to normal after that. Okay? Yes. Okay.
She wants to know if anyone has ever, like, floated off during a spacewalk.
Well, so, yeah, and that's a good question. So when we do a spacewalk, we have tethers to hold us on, right? And so but we have actually multiple tethers. We have one that's the last ditch one, which is an 85-foot retractable tether kind of thing. And right, and then you don't want to get to that point. And then when you get to a work site, we have a shorter one, just like a 4-foot one we put on to make sure we stay in our local area. And that's what we really concentrate on. But there has been times when people have gone off farther than they should, luckily they had the 85-foot one on and could get back, right? And that's I only know of one case of that happening. And but it was a pretty dramatic thing. And we tried not to do that at all. But there is, I know, one case then that has happened. But we never had anything without anybody having any tether and getting, you know, far away like that. Yes. Mission failures. Well, one thing, everybody's going to mess up at some point, all right? That's just life. We retrain hard, but, you know, when you're doing so many different things and every day, yeah, at some point you're going to make a mistake. And so we've all done that, but nothing really critical. What we've had, though, on my first space shuttle mission was we have thermal blankets to help us protect us when we come back into Earth, right? Well, one of those got rolled back on launch. We had to go out and do a spacewalk to put it back and secure it back on. So it wasn't a big deal, but we had to make sure we did it right. And it had never been done before in space, so we had to figure out, along with the ground, how to get that done. And that was kind of actually fun, because of, like, problem solving and figuring out how we were going to do that. So that was one of the things. But besides that, not too much. I mean, there's a lot of little things that don't work. We just work through them, just like you're working around your house or whatever. Things break, and you fix them, stuff like that. Oh, I got one back there. Yeah. How do you sleep in space? Good question. So we do have a sleeping bag we're in. However, it's not only really to hold you in place, right? It's not like it's thick to keep you warm, because it's not that cold on the space station. It's always 72 degrees. And so you attach your sleeping bag to either the wall, the floor, the ceiling, wherever you want to put it. It doesn't matter, because it doesn't matter what your orientation is. And then you float on into your sleeping bag and you zip it up. Now, the most difficult thing for me, at least for going to being a part of sleeping, was going to sleep. And that's because when you try to go to sleep here on Earth, you have a pillow and you have a blanket and you're just used to these triggers to help you go to sleep. Well, in space, you're like sleeping standing up, because you're just like this and you're trying to go to sleep and you're like, come on, right? Well, it was difficult at the beginning to learn how to do that, but everybody figures out a way to do that after a while. But once you go to sleep, it is the best night's sleep you're probably gonna get, because you're on the best mattress. You know, you're floating. There are no trigger points. Your neck is fine when you wake up. There's no back pain. There's nothing, because you're just floating in space. Yes. regular tasting food that I've ever had up in space. Our food, most of the foods, like say we get packages that we just heat up, are standard things like, you know, from spaghetti and meatballs to brisket even we had. And so standard foods like that. Now they weren't near as good as the foods you get here, but they were still similar in that way. So there was lots of standard food we had while we were up there. It just wasn't as tasty. Yes. What advice do people want to be an astronaut? To be an astronaut, first you have to have a degree in science or engineering. So hopefully you'll like that stuff, because that's what you need to do, right? But then the second one is that they don't really care what area of science or engineering you do. So find the one you like the best is the next thing, because that way you'll do the best in it, right? And you don't have to work that hard, because if you like it, it's not work anymore, right? So that's what I like that way back, because I realized, for me, my journey was I became an engineer first, and I realized, and all the things I did, I liked anyway. So, you know, I went on and got a master's and a PhD, but it's stuff I already liked doing. You know, and a job I had at NASA as an engineer was fantastic. I got to do the software in this really unique aircraft called a shuttle training aircraft, which was an airborne simulator shuttle. It got started off in the software. Then I got moved over to doing both software and flight operations. I got to fly and train astronauts, do all this kind of stuff. And I realized I really like that stuff. Right? And I didn't know that until I did it, but it was just amazing. So that opportunities, and then, you know, instead of getting a PhD, it was still fun because I like to learn and all that aspect of it. And really also, besides this, that aspect of getting a good education, getting some operational experience, which is either like flying or, you know, working science out in the field, or proving that you can be in this unique environment and still do well, right? And then also just being well-rounded, because you're competing against, like last, I think, application process, there was 18,000 applicants for 10 slots, right? So you have to figure out what you can do on this resume to stand out. And for me, I did just because I like doing different things, you know, like the backpack and stuff, but I got into ultra marathons. And I was doing these in the woods. They were 50, you know, mile runs in the woods kind of thing, and taking all day kind of things. But just anything like this, anything you can show that you can handle adversity and is interesting like that, because you have to kind of market yourself in a way. Think of that too, right? You have to be the one selling yourself in these interview processes, all right?
We have time for about two more questions.
All right, two more. All right, yes. How fast can a rocket go? Well, it can go, that's a good question, but it all depends on where it's gonna go, because like if you're going to the moon, you have to go faster than if you're going up to space. And the way they do that, they're with different stages. So when we go to just what we call low Earth orbit, that's where I was, it's 17,500 miles an hour. Now, if you're going on to the moon, now you're talking over 20,000 miles an hour. Right, but they do that with a different set of engines each time they go on that. So it all depends. But the rocket, once it gets out of the atmosphere, they can keep going faster and faster and faster as long as you have rockets and fuel. Right? Yes. Oh, your best times in space and worst times in space. The best time is definitely the playing stuff. Right? That was fun. Right? That was really fun. Probably the worst times in space is there's a job you got to do every day. What we do here at home too is a, you know, more of a biological job, say. And remember, everything floats. So you never really liked that job. That was not a fun thing to do. You just had to get through that every day. What happens in a blackout? Hold home close. That's very good. Yeah, you're not coming home. Yeah, yes, exactly. We would become the first people to know what's actually in a black hole. All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, let's give Dr. Swanson a hand.
A huge thanks to Steve for coming by the Cosmosphere that week to give two talks. And I think he met with some kids one of the other days too. Just a great person. I wish I would have been able to hang out there a little bit longer. Chuck with the Cosmosphere was able to ask Steve some questions that we came up with for the podcast. And I am so glad that Chuck remembered to ask that last final one here in just a few minutes. So I hope you enjoy this bonus Q&A with astronaut Steve Swanson.
So we're approaching the 15th anniversary of STS-119, your final space shuttle mission. Do you have any thoughts you'd like to share about the mission and your role in building the ISS?
Oh, just to being part of that project to build the ISS, I'm just so proud to be part of that team. The team at NASA that did that, I mean, there's thousands of people who were involved, and it was just fantastic. Everybody was so passionate about that mission and wanted to get it done. And to have that and have everybody working so hard and being part of that, it was just great.
What moment during STS-119 were you most proud of? And is there a question you wish people would ask about that mission?
That's a good question. For me personally, though, it was about the spacewalk. So that was the lead spacewalker. And on our second spacewalk, I was out with another person, and we ran into an issue with one of the pieces not working like it was supposed to. And this other person thought it was their fault that it happened that way, but it really wasn't their fault. And we were working with Mission Control to figure out what was going on. And the next time they were going to go out and fix it, I was going to be inside and running the checklist while the two new people went outside again to work on it. And we had a big discussion about should me being the most experienced go out and do it, or should we let those two people do it? And I voted for letting the other two people doing it because I thought that was the right thing. They had trained for it. They knew what they were doing. And I could be the most help inside the vehicle, walking them through it. And that, to me, was great because I got this person who was feeling very bad about what had happened the first one, to get him go out again on that next one and have it go successful, I think changed his whole career path on being an astronaut.
As we approach the end of the ISS era, how do you think history will remember the station? On the same track, what do you hope it's remembered for?
Oh, man, how will history remember the space station? Hopefully, it's when we started living in space permanently. That's what we've been having since 2000. We've had permanent residents on board the space station, and we're going to hopefully continue that and have a permanent presence in space from now on. And that's where that all started. So hopefully that's one of the legacies of the space station, plus and all the science that has been done already on the space station. The things we're learning is just so valuable, I think, to our humanity. I hope that is actually something also that comes out of that.
And then was the bat on the side of the shuttle, was that STS-119?
Yes, it was.
Did you guys learn about that while you were in space? Or
I don't remember. I think we did. Yeah, we didn't know about it beforehand. Yes, we got some pictures and stuff of it to us. Yes.
That's kind of fun. All right. That one was my question.
Okay.
That's it for this episode of the Cosmosphere Podcast. We appreciate you listening. We would love to hear your feedback or questions, or if you have ideas for the show, please reach out to the Cosmosphere on social media and let us know what you think. We've got some exciting things lined up for this year, and we hope that you'll join us. Be sure to follow the Cosmosphere on social media. And as always, watch out on Cosmo.org for the calendar of events at the Cosmosphere. All of those links will be in the show notes for this episode, so make sure to check those out and follow along. We'd love to see you in person. For the Cosmosphere, I'm John Molnix. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you soon.